Welcome to the Full of Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 8:25 British Summer Time. Today is May 24th, and today, of course, being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. Now, this has been a particularly eventful week, and much of that eventfulness was sparked by some comments made by Ben Bernanke Wednesday, and where he said that they were thinking about how they might tail back or reduce the amount of liquidity that they're adding to the market on a monthly basis. And the S&P formed quite a large downside key day reversal, and a number of other markets did something similar. And the Japanese market, having doubled in the last year, pulled back incredibly sharply yesterday and was down over 7%. And all of this should really be put in the context of what has actually been going on in the last 6 months. And since November and the announcement that Operation Twist would be retired and that quantitative easing indefinitely would be implemented, we've been presented with this remarkably persistent advance. And persistent advances are something that we've become somewhat accustomed to in the last 4 years, and really in the era of quantitative easing. Because back in 2011, the removal of quantitative easing resulted in an incredibly sharp pullback, and the implementation, or the announcement of quantitative easing 2, resulted in a remarkably persistent advance until it was also removed. And then we had an even greater pullback. And with QE3, we've been presented with unlimited amounts of liquidity being added to the system. And then we've had this incredibly persistent advance. And despite the fact that we have short-term overbought conditions relative to the 200-day moving average, this remains a reasonably consistent advance on Wall Street. We had a downside key day reversal this week, and at a minimum, that's a peak of near-term significance. It, in the context of the medium term, it could be viewed as at least a warning shot across the bows for this particular portion of the advance. But so far, the reaction hasn't really been anything greater than what we've seen since November. And that has been reactions in the region of 40 to 60 points for the S&P 500. And when we look at exactly what is going on, then we can go back and look at what's happened in the last 3 or 4 years and see that when this extraordinary monetary easing is removed, then markets tend to take fright and have tended to pull back really rather sharply. And until people really started to digest exactly what Mr. Bernanke was talking about, that was what they were beginning to price into markets. As we approach the close on Wall Street, the S&P is reasonably unchanged. But it hasn't rallied to any great extent either. And the likelihood of us now being in a reversionary type environment has increased. And at the minimum, it has moved into another one of these little ranges that could persist for upwards of a month. What we are now looking at, though, is that bull markets, one of the definitions of a bull market is that it will rally on good news and bad news. But what we are now starting to see with this particular market, in a schizophrenic type environment that it is that the market goes up on bad news and tends to weaken on good news. And if there were any additional evidence required to say that we are addicted to liquidity in this environment, then that really has to be it. Because the Fed will be looking at inflation numbers, and they'll be looking at unemployment numbers, but we know for a fact that unemployment is a lagging indicator. And they'll be looking at just about every other type of economic indicator as well. And if they start to see that there is any chance of the velocity of money picking up, and not least if it moves on to a sustained growth footing, or a sustained upward trajectory on that velocity indicator, then they will have little choice but to remove some of that liquidity. And that will represent perhaps the most obvious potential challenge to stock markets in the medium term. In the short term, we have had a shock. And when people are shocked, they don't tend to jump straight back in. And that would suggest that when we look at something that has been rising for not just a few consecutive weeks, but when an instrument has rallied for 17 of 18 consecutive weeks, and Johnson & Johnson offers a very good example of that. It broke out of a 12-year consolidation, and that was characterized by a generational-long process of P/E ratio contraction and rising dividend yields. And Johnson & Johnson is emblematic of the autonomies, and it offers a cross-section of the healthcare equipment and pharmaceuticals and consumer healthcare sectors. And the company has also been raising its dividend for the last 40 consecutive years. So it's got really quite impressive dividend growth statistics. And we look at a lengthy range as an explosion waiting to happen. And as long as something is ranging for a very long period of time, then expectations go down. And I produce a chart back in January of the number of shares outstanding on the New York Stock Exchange. And I had to reverse engineer it from the percentage of short interest in the market. But what it showed was that the supply of stocks went up in the 1990s, and not least because we were in one of the greatest bull markets in history, and the incentive to list your company was that much greater. You were getting the best price that one might ever have expected to get for anything that was related to the technology or telecoms or media sectors. So the supply of shares on the index exploded. And following the NASDAQ crash, the number of shares stopped going up and started going sideways. And that persisted all the way through to about 2010. And then it started to deteriorate. And we've seen over the last few years that there have been share buybacks, and there have been private equity takeovers. And even though we've had some incredibly high-profile IPOs such as Facebook, what we have also seen is that the amount of regulation that is now in place and the amount of compliance that a company has to agree to in order to seek a listing is actually encouraging a number of listed companies to go private, and Dell is a good example of that. And it actually indicates that the supply of equities is deteriorating. So classy companies with strong balance sheets that have been buying back their shares for a lengthy period of time could in some cases be considered collector's items. And we don't value collector's items on a discounted cash flow basis. We value them on a rarity basis, just like we would with art. So that opens up another avenue for looking at some of these incredibly high-profile companies that have leveraged the growth of the global consumer. And the global consumer is probably the story that is likely to inspire people for the next decade. The global economy has gone from being mostly rural to mostly urban. More people are moving to cities. Productivity tends to improve when people move to cities. That means that generally people would have more time and more money, and more people get provided governance is improving, then people move up into the middle classes and their consumption goes up. The per capita consumption of just about everything starts to improve. And these types of companies that did nothing for the 12 years between 1999, 2000 and 2012 are now starting to break up out of these long ranges. And when we see that type of base formation completion, it tells us that there really is a fundamental story. And it's not that difficult to ascertain what that story is. And it's a story that people can understand. And while one can stand around and make very lengthy investment cases, it is the really simple stories that can get people really animated. And lifting a billion people, if not 2 billion people, out of poverty and into the middle classes, the greatest eradication of poverty in the history of the world, is a really, really big story. And when we look at something that has been ranging for such a long time, and that expectations go down, and the very fact that the number of shares outstanding on the New York Stock Exchange has gone down is a really good indication of just how low expectations are. And when we look at how the holdings of shares are reflected in people's portfolios, and we look at the recommendations of Wall Street strategists as to what your breakdown of debt to equity should be, and that peaked at about 70% in favor of equity back in 1999, and it bottomed at the end of last year close to 40%, and has since rebounded to just under 50%. We can anticipate that by the time we get to the end of a bull market in equities, then that recommended weighting will be back up towards 70%. And we're a very long way from there. And when we look at what people are actually holding, people hold a lot of bonds and the volatility that has been evident in the stock market. And the fact that people have had to endure some very abrupt swings is not confidence inducing. And people's expectations of what upside potential could possibly occur tend to go down. So even though over the last 4 years we've had a really impressive rally, and we've seen the S&P breaking out to new all-time highs, and we've seen a number of high-profile shares completing these lengthy base formations, the amount of people that are actually heavily long of equities is comparatively low. And when we look at the very large asset managers, and we look at the government bond markets, then we're presented with additionally interesting conditions. Because not only have governments been increasing the supply of bonds, and that story has been well covered in just about all media, but also they've been changing the rules to ensure that they're creating a market for these bonds. So quantitative easing, obviously, is one of those policies. And central banks getting in there and supporting government bond prices and hoovering up new issues is definitely helping the massively indebted governments. But they're also changing the regulatory environment so that in the US and in the UK, they're changing how risk can be considered within a pensions portfolio. And if you want to have a riskless part of your portfolio, then they necessitate now that you have to own treasuries and you have to own gilts, and they can't be substituted for corporate bonds or the bonds of highly rated corporates. They have to be gilts, and they have to be treasuries. So that is literally creating a market for the securities that you are printing. And it also goes to illustrate just what the perceptions of risk are and where the administrations see where the risk is, and people looking at their most recent experience and attempting to learn lessons. And of course, we all want to learn lessons from our past experience. And the additional lesson is knowing when to implement those lessons, because we've been through an incredibly difficult decade. And that's a decision-making process. And a lot of people have made the decision that they don't want to be in equities. But as we see these shares breaking up out of these lengthy base formations, then that's new bull market type action. And at the present moment, we're at a very interesting juncture because we've had this incredibly impressive rally. And I'll go back to Johnson & Johnson, where it rallied for 17 of 18 weeks. And this is the 19th week, and it's pulling back. And not in a particularly dynamic fashion, but it's certainly been weak. So there's absolutely nothing has occurred to question the possibility that shares that have done this. And it is worth pointing out that it isn't just in healthcare or in the consumer sector, but we're seeing an increasing number of industrial shares breaking out of 12 and 13 year ranges. Honeywell, Illinois Tool Works, just in the last couple of months. And the industrial gases are also breaking up out of these reasonably lengthy ranges in here. So all of these shares have this global orientation, and the consumer and the manufacturing sectors tend to run to very different rhythms. One is very much geared towards the emergence of the consuming class, and the other is more leveraged to global GDP growth. And GDP growth globally has been a bit disappointing of late. And yet we're seeing these industrial shares continuing to extend their advances. And part of the reason for that is that they're benefiting from technological innovation. And technological innovation represents an incredible growth story, not least because it improves productivity. But when we look at what's happening at present, we've had this incredible breakout, and we've had such a remarkably persistent advance that when we start to see those advances losing some of that consistency, and accelerations are the kinds of things that we hang around for in markets and wait to see and attempt to participate in. But when an acceleration ends, then, and particularly if it happens in a dynamic fashion, as has just happened with Japan, then it's a cause for reassessment. And at a minimum, it suggests that it's a peak of near-term significance, and that the potential now is that we're going to see some consolidation of these incredibly impressive gains. And that is likely to set us up for the next big buying opportunity, because in assets that have completed these lengthy base formations, then we expect to see the massive breakouts, and we expect to see the huge move way beyond the expectations of the people that have been looking at it within the range. But when people then start to ask the question as to what's really changed, and can we justify where prices are right now, and what are the risks? Is my risk buying today greater than the possibility that the market is going to pull back? And that can shove us into a range. And it's not unusual that we see a first step above the base forming, where a range in consolidation allows the demand component to regroup before new highs can be justified. And when we look at what has been happening with some of the particularly the most overextended shares, then the likelihood of that occurring has increased. And when we look at exactly what's happening with the Fed, then they're going to tailor their policy, I think, and that's not an unreasonable thing to do, considering that the Fed was quite a significant contributor to the credit and property bubble that followed the Nasdaq crash, because it left the liquidity in the system for far too long. So they've also learned their lessons that removing the liquidity too quickly is going to create these gyrations in the market. And that would suggest that they're going to remove the liquidity that they're currently adding, or they're going to reduce that liquidity on a piecemeal basis. And eventually they'll get back to stopping adding liquidity, and then they'll begin to withdraw some. But it's likely to be a lengthy process, and it's not going to be like a switch going on and off. And that suggests that some of the extraordinarily leveraged strategies that have been implemented over the last couple of years will begin to come under pressure. And despite the fact that the S&P has had one downward dynamic and has been ranging in the region of the lows of Wednesday for the last couple of days, mortgage REITs have been pulling back rather sharply. And that's the asset class that is perhaps most leveraged to abundant liquidity and very low interest rates. So that is also an area which is susceptible here at the bare minimum. And there will be plenty of high-frequency trading type operations that will be taking on a great deal of leverage and are also very sensitive to changes in that macro environment. When we look at the world on a geographic basis, then Wall Street has been in this lengthy range and has just broken out of it and does look like it is going to hold the majority of that advance. And that is based on the assumption that while there is the possibility that the liquidity that has been injected will be tailed back, that it will not be just removed. And Europe remains a union of very old countries. But in fact, the Eurozone is really only a 15-year-old country, and it's going through some significant growing pains. And when we look at where policy meets politics, well, the politics is trying to sell a lot of what has been agreed to recalcitrant voters, but the policy is for United States of Europe, and there's no guarantee that every country that's currently sharing the euro is going to be a part of that, but it does look like that is the way that it is going to go, and that's going to take time, and the debt issues that are outstanding in Europe are going to represent a headwind for the domestic economies, particularly on the periphery for the really the significant future. And until we see a resolution to that, which could potentially involve some sort of debt forgiveness, then the domestic part of the Eurozone economy is going to be under pressure. But the UK, German, French and Italian stock markets are replete with companies that are leveraged to global growth, and not least the UK. And these types of autonomies are likely to continue to represent the growth leaders and dividend growth leaders over the next number of years. And they continue to represent some of the shares that have the most consistent uptrends. And when one looks at the risk and reward that is evident in markets, then we are looking for the most consistent trends and then looking to implement a trend following strategy. And when we think about what that strategy might be, then when something becomes wildly overextended relative to a trend mean, then the potential for a reversion to that mean has increased. And the best time to take profits is when something is wildly overextended relative to the trend mean, because you'll almost certainly get a better opportunity to pick it up at a lower price later, and you'll have the luxury of being able to reassess. So when we look at where the trends are, anything that is really wildly overextended is susceptible to some consolidation. But considering the fact that what we've had is at least a pause here, not everything is going to pull back violently. And when we look at what's happening in Japan, the yen was a little bit stronger in here today, almost a full yen stronger, but it still has the progression of lower rally highs against the dollar. And provided they remain the case, and provided the yen continues to trend lower, then the Nikkei, having pulled back by 1,500 points this week, could form a first step above the base. And I think that remains the most likely scenario, that it will hold the majority of its recent advance and that it will form a ranging consolidation and allow investors to digest exactly what has happened. It's been the flavor of the month for momentum traders, probably more accurately, the flavor of the last 6 months. But there's still a lot of people sitting on the sidelines that have yet to participate and want to participate. And if this is not just a flash in the pan, and if the Japanese get the governance right and implement the reform agenda that they've promised to do, then Japan could be on a new secular uptrend, and that we could really be in the foothills of a significant bull market. But it was subject to governance, as is absolutely everything in terms of countries and stock markets. So it represents an opportunity, considering the fact that it had gone up on consecutive weeks and had this incredible advance. Well, if one wants to buy, then you wait for the pullback and you wait for it to look to find support, not least in the region of a trend mean like the 200-day moving average. So we're 1 week off the high, and the moving average will be catching up at a prodigious pace. And if we do see a ranging consolidation, then we'll have some additional evidence. And what's been perhaps most interesting about Japan is that the banking sector led on the upside and on the downside, and it peaked about 10 days ahead of the wider market. It also means that when the banking sector returns to a position of outperformance, then the chances are that we'll have seen the bottom of this reaction, and it will be a reasonably good indication that the market will probably start to go back up. And India is another interesting candidate. It pulled back sharply on Wednesday following, or on Thursday, excuse me, following the announcement by Mr. Bernanke. But the index was right up there at the peak. And I posted an interesting report this week from Deutsche Bank talking about the fact that the rail authority in India has acquired 98% of the land that it needs to begin construction of a new freight rail network for India. Now, infrastructure has been the one thing that India, more than any other factor, has lacked, and not least when compared to China. And if, and we really won't know until we see the first rails laid, but if India can actually get this going and can really get major infrastructure projects off the ground, then that represents really a transformative change, perhaps in the perceptions of how people view India. So when we look at this market, and it's not that far off, it's 2011 and 2008 peaks, and it hasn't pulled back by nearly as much as it could have, despite the heightened sense of anxiety. And what it does look like is that it is in a process of reverting back towards the mean. And provided it finds support in the region of the 200-day moving average, then the potential for a successful upward break will be heightened. And that would also represent very, very interesting developments indeed, not least because India is probably going to become the biggest population country in the world in the next decade. And China, the stock market continues to find support here and to improve on a very mild basis in the region of the 200-day moving average, having pulled back and unwound its overbought condition over the last few months. And they are doing their utmost to support the consumer economy and roll out healthcare and a social security net in an effort to free up the savings of the Chinese consumer. And at the same time, and at least part of that reason of that policy is trying to bring down the price of property, which isn't the easiest thing to do, not least because there isn't a property tax, and that means provincial governments rely on land sales to for tax revenue, but also because the capital markets are relatively shallow and there isn't a well-developed corporate bond market, and it means that people have the stock market or property in which to invest, and they haven't been investing in the stock market, so they've been investing in property. and trying to convince people that they should be investing in something else when there aren't a great number of additional options is a difficult prospect. So China has this issue with how they can control the price of property while stimulating other parts of the economy. And at present, they have been tightening some of the liquidity, and that has weighed on the banking sector a little bit in here over the last few months. But at the same time, the stock market is cheap and valuations are attractive. And when we look at where this market could potentially go and what the likely outcome is, considering that valuations are low and that it is finding support in the region of the 200-day moving average, then it does look like it is only a matter of time before the Chinese market starts to perform in here. And when we look at what's happening in stocks, and we look at what has been really quite an impressive advance over the last 6 months, and the fact that gold has been under quite a bit of pressure, and the Dow gold ratio hit a low around 6 in, I think it was 2011. And at present, it's trading at 11 times. So that ratio has broken the progression of lower rally highs that's been evident since 1999. And what we would need to see is a significant deterioration in the Dow or a significant rally in gold to turn it back around. And gold has at least steadied this week above its April lows. But at the bare minimum, it needs to get above $1,400 to suggest anything more than temporary steadying. And realistically, it needs to get back above $1,500 to begin to break the progression of lower rally highs and suggest that demand is returning to dominance beyond the short term. So it really has a lot to do. And the fact that it has this overhead top formation that is the hallmarks of having been completed is not a particularly bullish factor. So we have to consider the possibility that gold has topped out, and that the fact that the equity markets are doing that bit better and that we're seeing base formation completion in an increasing number of globally oriented shares suggests that they could outperform not just in the short term but over the medium term and potentially even the longer term. And they're probably not going to do that. We're not going to see a major bull market on Wall Street until the quantitative easing question has been resolved. And we're really only at the beginning of the resolution of that question. And we could have quite a bit of ranging and a lengthy process of forming a first step above the base for the S&P while that liquidity is being withdrawn or while the quantitative easing question is being considered. But if we do see the global economy moving back onto a sustained growth footing, then the need for such incredibly low interest rates will be reduced. And governments, instead of attempting to inflate their way out of their problems, may start to think about how they might be able to grow their way out of their problems with a little bit of help from moderate inflation. But that would mean that interest rates would need to be higher. And if interest rates are higher, then yields will be higher. And anyone who's buying government bonds at this level and anticipating that they're going to represent value, I think is probably going to be disappointed. And the way to look at that is on a total return basis, because pensions buy bonds on a total return basis. And that is one of the most consistent trends there is. And just like when we were looking at the ETF holdings of gold, and pointing out the fact that it was an incredibly consistent 10-year uptrend, and that when it lost that consistency, it would spell trouble for gold. Well, we can say something very similar for bonds, that when the total return index, which has been so incredibly consistent since its genesis in 1983, when it loses that consistency, and all we can say at present is that it has lost momentum, but when it breaks through the 200-day moving average and posts a larger reaction than we've seen in the last few years, and perhaps more importantly, when it encounters resistance in the region of the MA, then the bond bull market will be over. And there'll be a race on to find the types of instruments that have the potential to increase their dividends and have strong records of dividend growth. And that brings us back full circle to the types of companies that are becoming collector's items, and they'll become even more in demand when the bond market eventually tops out. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.